Welcome to Conversation X Nilo. This is Billy. Thank you so much for joining me. Well, looks like school is about to start. I hope everybody is prepared for that. Today I have a guest that has very little to do with school, although I guess in a way she kind of does. Forgive me for measuring everything by when school starts, but it's just kind of that season, right? And it helps me to mark time, especially, you know, after a year of COVID when time was very difficult to mark and every day was kind of the same. So I hope wherever you're listening to this, things are getting back to normal, at least a little bit for you and yours. Back to my guest today. My guest's name is Jules. She just goes by Jules. There's a bit of anonymity in that, and I'll explain why. Jules is a professional dominatrix, although she prefers the term femdom. I stumble a little bit in the interview over the, you know, kind of pluralization or even turning it into a noun, right? In the dominatrixing industry, dominatrixes, it's tricky. I like the word though, dominatrix. It's a cool sounding word. It's a very tough word. Femdom, it's okay. You know, it's what she prefers. It's, to me, it's an abbreviation. Feminine domination. Ah, that sounds kind of cool when you really put it all together. Anyway, her story involves a lot of personal trauma and a lot of abuse as a child, which led to her becoming sober at the age of 35, which then led to her becoming a dominatrix, which is really tricky if you're in a recovery program. As she talks about in her book, there's a lot of judgment there, but you can see how it definitely turned her life around. That is, if you take the time to read the book and listen to some of this interview. From there, she went on to become a competition bodybuilder at the age of, I believe, 48 or so. I mean, she's an incredible woman, very strong and very inspirational. I mean, I really enjoyed this book. I really try to read all my guest books, at least part of it. I finished this book in a couple of days. It's a quick read. It's gripping at times. It's sad. It's kind of funny at times. I fully recommend it. Sometimes I distinguish between all women should read this book or all men should read. Just read the book, whether you're a man, woman, a them, or a they. It doesn't matter. Dom, sub, anything in between, read the book. The Making of a Woman from the Inside Out. I'm fascinated with the whole fetishization industry. You know, I keep coming up with this word industry, and you'll hear me again stumble on this in the interview because I don't know what else to call it. Is it an industry? Is it a way of life? Is it a culture? Is it a company? Is it, you know, a religion? Is it a little bit of everything? You know, I think most people, if you're inside it, of course you're fascinated by it, but if you're on the outside of it, it's so fucking interesting, isn't it? I mean, leather, whips, collars, all that kind of stuff. I think I approach it from a philosophical point of view as to, like, why? Why? Why does this exist? I wanted to ask her a little bit about the history of the domination culture. But we didn't really get a chance to get into it too much. And I would like to do that maybe on a future episode, because it's fascinating to me, right? Like, every discipline, no pun intended, has a history to it, right? I mean, there's a history to teaching, there's a history to being a doctor, there's a history to law, there's a history to auto mechanics. Every profession kind of has this history and a lore behind it too. So I'm kind of interested into as to how this became a viable, number one, way to make a living, but number two, just something that people willingly pay for. It's not all that mysterious to me, believe me. You know, she talks a lot in her book about, you know, the men who typically come to see her are men who are very, very powerful men, very, very rich men. And there's something about having, like, a lot of power, and there's something about having everything go so easy for you that you want challenge. You know, you almost want people to challenge you. You almost want somebody to slap you in the face. You know, you get to a point where, you know, arrogance can only take you so far before you need to be kicked in the teeth so that you can kind of come back, right? Because the human story is one of tribulation and triumph. If your whole life is just triumph, what the hell do you do? Where is there to go, right? You know? So I understand it, I think, psychologically. You know, in Ernest Becker's book, The Denial of Death, which, as you know, I'm a huge fan of, he talked a lot about this, about the fetish culture, right? And he kind of likened it to, you know, forming magic totems, things like that. Dig this, right? He says, as Freud himself remarked, all cultural contrivances are self-hypnotic devices, from motor cars to moon rockets, ways that a sorely limited animal can drum up to fascinate himself with the powers of transcendence over natural reality, as no one can be exactly comfortable in the species submergence of his distinctive inner self. All of us use a bit of magical charming in our relations to the world. I love that. We all use it. We all use it. I also like when he was speaking specifically of foot fetishism. I quote, "The foot is a dumb-looking thing. Isn't it? Isn't it just?" I don't know. Fascinating stuff. So, enjoy my interview with Jules. If you have questions, comments, if you know anybody in this industry lifestyle who can speak to me about the history of it a little bit, I would love to have them on and talk. Reach me on Twitter at ConvoXNilo. You can always email me, billy@convoxnilo.com. You can find Jules' book in the show notes. I'll also include a link to her trailer. It was a pretty cool trailer, too. I mean, the book really is for those who are struggling, have struggled, who know... you know, young people who may be hiding some pretty sad stuff. You know, it's kind of, I don't want to say it's a call to action, but it's definitely a call to thought. It's a call to thought. Enjoy my conversation with Jules. Let's go. Watch your bro.
Definitely. I mean, I think back in college, I was told I need to write a book. But as I got sober, then I got to the point where it was like I had so many blackouts in my story. And I was like, it's just never going to work. And then my husband and I, we sail. We have a sailboat. And we were out on the ocean during the COVID thing. And I was able to start putting together this timeline of spaces that I wasn't able to, you know, fill in. So in January, then I reached out to Marlena and said, I need your help. I need your help. I said, I want to put this in, you know, I want to put this into words. I need to reach out to other women. I have too much knowledge to not give this away. Right. And so we started in January and finished up in probably the later part of June, early July.
How did you end up finding Marlena? How did you guys get in touch?
You know what? Source does fantastic things for me like that. And so it was this process of, you know, talking to somebody about maybe even writing the book, who then said, oh, you've got to talk to my friend and my friend and my friend and my friend and my friend. And then, oh, try this website. And then I think it's called WeWorks, I think. And okay. So I went through and then she happened to be in the state I live in. So, you know, I reach out to her and she was like, oh, well, we're actually in Mystic, Connecticut right now. Of course you are. That's where we keep our boat.
No kidding.
Is in Mystic. Okay. So it was just a lot of those like, okay, I hear you loud and clear. And she's a similar story with multiple books behind her. So she was absolutely perfect to be able to not only tell my story, but then to be able to bring it back to me and to read my story in the eyes of another woman was profound. We don't get that opportunity. So I'm totally grateful.
So was it a process of asking you a lot of questions? I mean, did it have to be done in such a way to get you to kind of fill in those gaps?
Absolutely. Every week we had a standing appointment on Tuesdays. And so she would, you know, we'd just started at the beginning and just, you know, and then she would write, I would edit it the next, and then the next week we go into where we left off.
It's amazing how that works, isn't it? That somebody can kind of, it takes a curious person to bring these things back to the surface.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And she was just so delicate about it. And also, I mean, as you go through any sort of trauma and then have somebody go, wow, there's a way it validates.
For sure.
So much that I've overlooked that as the years have gone by. I mean, that was how many years ago now? So
right.
It was really refreshing to hear that from another woman who's, you know, survived her fair share.
Yeah. I love how you began one of the chapters by saying that you wanted to be a nurse or a server when you were a little person. That was so interesting. Can you tell me a little bit about what your memories are? Can you go back that far and remember what you were thinking when you're sitting in that booth? Or,
you know, we didn't get to go out to dinner a lot. We were financially, we were pretty constrained. We didn't have a lot of extra. So to be able to go out and have dinner, I mean, that was a really big deal. And so, of course, the waitress is always happy. And I was just like, oh my gosh, and she makes me feel so good. I want to be like her. What does she do? She brings me my food. Oh my gosh, thank you. You ask if I need anything else. And we don't get this at home.
That's so amazing. I mean, it was such a, you know, an incident that most of us take for granted, right?
Totally.
And for you, that was just huge.
It was a really big deal.
Yeah. I mean, when I was a kid, I wanted to be a garbage man, I think for much the same reason. That's how I kind of related to it.
It's not necessarily the job. It's how I feel.
Yeah.
That's what attracted me. I didn't know what she did behind, like if she was doing dishes or none of that stuff. I just know she made me feel really good.
Wow. So when you started working when you were younger, did you end up doing food service, that kind of stuff?
Oh, I did.
Yeah.
I think that's, you know, I dropped out when I was in ninth grade. And so there wasn't many avenues I could take. So initially, yeah, it was a long line of fast food and serving, you know, there's restaurants and stuff too.
Well, I mean, just to, you know, share a little bit too, I also, you know, I dropped out at 14. I never finished high school and then went on to college. I'm currently getting a master's in education. So I work with a lot of students. Yeah. So there's a lot of your story that I couldn't help relate to. I mean, minus the trauma, fortunately for me, of course, but, you know, so many things, again, that I took for granted too, such as, again, just going to a restaurant was such a big deal for you. What it made me think about too, was a lot of the girls that I teach now, but girls that I went to school with. And I wonder, you know, how much were they hiding? You know, what was really going on? Because I have a really good memory. And when I look back, I can see all these signs that, you know, nobody knew, did they?
Yeah.
No. Nobody knows what the hidden life that some of these young people are living.
And in our household, it was very much, you know, the first household was very alcoholic. And mm-hmm. so everything, and then even the second marriage my mom chose was that stuff stayed inside. And so when we would go out to family or to this restaurant or, you know, I remember just being so angry, like, who is he? He doesn't act like this at home at all. I remember that just enraged me. Like, why is he playing like this?
You're talking about Robert. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I imagine how that must trigger like instant resentment, right? Because he's mm-hmm. a whole different person in public than in private.
Oh yeah. Charming and laughing and, oh yeah. And we were meant to be seen, not heard. So we were very quiet. My stepbrother, who is my same age, I mean, we just kind of hung out together and stayed small.
Yeah. Are you still close with your stepbrother?
No, I'm not close with any of that family. Mm-hmm. After recovery, I learned that family is really where nurturing and loving and support comes from. Mm-hmm. I found a lot of that within my circle of friends in recovery. And so it just worked out best this way.
Yeah, I understand completely.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you a couple of questions, maybe directly related to the book. And I mean, I know I don't know how long it was since you wrote it. So if you need me to provide any context based on some of the stuff, let me know. But normal, like what is normal? What does it mean to you?
Are you speaking in any particular part of?
Yeah, I mean, story? I'm talking about, yeah, yeah. When you mentioned normalcy being something of a Rubik's Cube, right? And okay. You've never really been able to kind of orient yourself. I mean, I understand what you mean. And I think I struggle with like, what does that mean anyway?
Always trying to fit into like this puzzle.
Yeah.
That's what, yeah. Yes, totally. And I think, you know, of course, growing up in that first phase, really having no idea what this larger family means and if what's happening is this normal. I mean, so that was a lot of confusion. And then as you know, I have very few mentors or older people around me because we don't really do much outside the house. And so then when I moved in, you know, left and kind of like really went into the depths of alcoholism, that's constantly what I was doing. I was not looking for a free ride. I was not looking to be taken care of. I was looking for a place to put my feet long enough so I could get up on my feet and on my own. So I was always trying to make it work, try to put it together, try to. And all I can think is that my mind, the way I thought about things, it was in the throes of alcoholism. So it no matter how hard I tried, it was probably going to be a disaster.
Well, and it's just so weird too, right? Because like, what do you use as a model, right? What is, exactly. What is normal? What you see on TV, I would imagine that plays a big part of it. I mean, it did for me growing up, right?
Oh gosh. And you know, part of my story is I live in California, right? So we have this whole persona of, you know, what it means to be respected. And, you know, I remember this, I mean, I drank sake, but I mean, because of the whole, you know, and martinis and the whole kind of paraphernalia that goes along with drinking, it was glamorous.
Yeah.
And so, yes, I remember actually watching the series Dallas, and they would all get together after dinner and, you know, and I'm like, that's the family I want. Look, the women are put together. If they get emotional, they, you know, the guys actually listen. It was like that. That was really the example I had. It was a very few TV shows that we watched.
Isn't that weird how like now a lot of the TV shows, recovery is a central theme to the TV show? Have you noticed that?
I do. I'm grateful just to see that it's out in the forefront.
It is. I mean, I said so much about, I think, the American culture, because a lot of the reason why I started this podcast, I think, is to really meditate on what it is to be an American. What is American culture? Where does it come from? What does it mean? And I can't help but notice things like AA specifically. Alcoholism is a disease that, you know, is rampant throughout the entire planet. Every country has some form of it. But AA specifically is an American invention. Kind of like superheroes and comic books. It's an American, it's a unique American invention. So those kinds of things make me wonder, like, what is unique about our relationship with these things, such as alcohol, such as sex, such as a lot of things? What is unique about the American experience?
I think if you're asking that question, I think it's the Band-Aid. Mm. It's the solution for things that I don't want to look at. Trauma typically that alcoholism is usually, you know, the supplement of trauma or something that went on in earlier years. And I think it's interesting how we normalize things. That's what really kind of surprises me. You know, people can, you know, go out and they can drink this and get wild and crazy. And as Americans, we think this is okay. Many times when I've been overseas, no, people don't get stupid drunk like that. You know,
they did in the places I lived in, but that was, you know, that was Eastern Europe where it's very common.
Okay.
But I understand what you mean. I've been to Western Europe too. And yeah, it's not like it is here. Not the same relationship.
Not at all. Not at all.
Do you think that we as Americans have a certain unique repression that we're working ourselves through? I mean, as a society?
Yes.
I imagined you would be a good person to ask about this.
Yes, absolutely. It's amazing. It's almost like an invisible veil. And it's all of the woulda, coulda, shouldas, all the shame. Growing up as a little girl, things that were imprinted in me, expected of me, you know, heaven forbid. I'm a human. I'm a sexual being, but we're not going to talk about that.
Right. Right.
It's a huge part of my being. Okay. Well, we don't talk about it. Well, now we've given pretty much the green light to any adult who's going to cross that line because we're afraid to even talk about it. Right. So, yes. And again, overseas, it was so much more fluid. Things were more open. I mean, I've been to nudist colonies over there where people are just beautiful humans. It doesn't have to be that nasty, dark, and, you know, and I think because we have this system that, I mean, if I wear short shorts, I'm either going to be praised or I'm going to be shamed.
Yeah.
It's my body. It's my body. It's like, I could do with it as I want, but all of the, you know, there's, and that's one of my blogs is there's no way, wrong way to be a woman. I'm judged on every part of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think about this a lot too, because I've been reading a lot about the founding of this country for some reason lately. And it's like, every time I have questions about why we're a little messed up, all I have to do is go back and remember that we were founded by religious nutcases and businessmen.
Yeah.
Like that's it. That really was the beginnings of our origin story. I mean, unlike England or Germany or France that had a lot of other factors in their origins, we were founded by businessmen and religious fanatics. And I don't think that we've ever been able to extricate ourselves from that influence. You know what I mean? I think because if you imagine like every immigrant that's ever come here, they are learning behaviors that stemmed from all of that, right?
Yes.
And so we're always just getting kind of watered down versions of like repression and you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's crazy how powerful it is.
Yeah.
That's what surprises me.
Oh, me too. Me too. But with you, you know, when you were young, you wrote in your book about, you know, working as a stripper, things like that. Did you feel like you were more, I don't know, liberated in a sense, mentally? Or was that still kind of, yeah?
No. For me, sex was a vehicle. Sex was the most powerful tool that I had at that time. Mm-hmm. I was programmed. Stay small. I don't want to hear what you say. This is something I really admire about you. You're going to get my love and attention when this is happening. So that is how that whole mindset was created. Now you back that up with a little bit of anger, rage, of course, disappointment, all of the things that go along with that. And for me to be on the stage in that position of power, I still was at the mercy of my clients, because ultimately they were paying my bills, but it was a way that I had something they wanted. Mm-hmm. And so there was a little bit of a charge there that I have a sliver of control when it comes to this part of my being. And that never was the case before. So I think that's what kept that going. And of course there's very good money in that industry.
Right. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, some of the stories you were telling about just traveling on the circuit were frightening. I mean, being in a strange town for a limited time, working for very shady people. Mm-hmm. I mean, you must have felt like constantly stressed out, like your life is threatened.
You know, you'd be surprised. You would be surprised. Now, if I were to take me and drop me in there now, I'm not equipped with the tools or the defenses. I don't have my armor any longer. Yeah. But growing up in an environment like that, you acquire, I mean, it's actually human nature. I mean, the baby comes out with the defenses it needs, right? And so mine, of course, was much older, but so I learned how to step out of my body. Mm-hmm. I learned how to do all of these things. And at this point, I'm feeling very invincible. Because really nobody can stop me in my mind. So it's interesting. It's not, yeah. Cause you think trauma is going to be, you know, it's scary or, you know, yeah, there's some scary times. Don't get me wrong. But then it like flipped right into ego of like, that's not going to happen.
Of course,
another defense mechanism.
For sure. And lucky with the, you know, the hindsight of being, having survived it, being able to look back and reflect is important.
Yeah.
Now, have you disarmed completely, or would you call that a new armor that you've fitted yourself with?
The beautiful thing about getting sober is I had to look at the armor. I had to realize that I was bringing a gun to a pencil fight. I was, I was a warrior. And so I had to learn to kind of tone it down, set it down. Okay, we don't need these right now. That's a really big learning curve. And so that took many years. And there's still times today where somebody will do something and all those armors, everything comes right back up.
Yeah.
That's a blessing, right? Those,
they
totally saved my life. I'm not hating on them at all, but now it's to my, the challenge is to find safety in my environment when I'm constantly, I still have that. I still have that feeling of like, is this safe? Is this not safe? Is he telling me the truth? Is he not telling me the truth? Mm. That is constantly going on. But I think overall, my defenses are down. I don't need to protect myself to the degree I used to, but it's still learning in process.
Right. Mm-hmm. It's got to feel very, I mentioned liberating earlier about being a stripper. You sound much more liberated now.
I am.
Yeah.
Isn't that surprising?
It is. Yeah. I
mean, yeah. And again, like sobriety was like, you know, we clear out, we do some steps, we look at our stuff, we, you know, fix the stuff that was ours, you know, leave the stuff that wasn't. And, you know, over that, it gave me this clean slate, which was amazing. I did not wake up with heart palpitations and I didn't wake up thinking, oh, you know, oh my God, like I got to pay that bill, or all of that went away. And it was so, it's such a beautiful feeling to wake up and like ease into the day instead of catapult into the day. Right.
I know what you mean. Yeah.
Totally. Yeah. It's a total game changer on what your day is going to be like. And so, I try to take that time every morning as I ease into the day and fuel my thought process with things that are going to benefit me throughout the day. So, and the more I learn about myself, my likes, my dislikes. I mean, because before I was told what I liked and what I didn't like. And so now it's like, wow, my favorite color, I think it's yellow, you know, like micro baby things like that, one upon the next, but next. And it's like, no, this is who I am. I really like this person. So
I thought that part was so interesting. Yeah. When you basically had to ask yourself some real, like, basic questions, right?
Totally.
What is your favorite
music?
What is your favorite color? Yeah. You know, you realize at one point that you didn't know yourself at all, right?
Mm-mm. Mm-mm. Yeah. And things that were common for other people. You know, it's like I got sober when I was 35. And it's, I just think of it as like, you know, Source dropped me like on Planet Sober. Like, there you go. You don't know the language. You don't know the culture. You don't have anything to fall back on. Just the here and now. And so when people would say, where do you want to go on vacation? I can't, I have no idea. Like, what are my options? Right. Like I didn't have that growing up, you know, or watching, you know, movies where you're like, oh, I would love to go to, you know, that was absent. And so getting sober is not for the weak at all. Cause it's a lot of uncertainties, but I think that's where the uncertainties is where I find me. Right.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And so, but it was, so after I was getting sober at 35 is when you discovered the dominatrix industry, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's what I think was, there's a lot of things I think are interesting about it, but one thing that I thought was really cool was, you know, there's a history to everything that a lot of people take for granted. There's a history of education. There's a history to medicine with science. There's a history to being a dominatrix, right? Mm-hmm. And you talked a little bit about it in the book, and the book isn't really necessarily about that, but I was just kind of curious, like, what did you discover about I hesitate to call it an industry, it's more of a lifestyle in a sense, right? Like, what did you discover about the history of it? Where it began? What was it, What need was it addressing, I guess?
You know, it began when I moved into a new relationship, and he was a top, which was more of the dominant energy. And at the time, I was very unstable. As he'd mentioned, I was a lost soul. And I remember I wanted anything and everything to connect with him. And I remember seeing the books and the goodies, the toys. And I said, I want you to collar me. And he's like, do you have any idea what that means? And even in the throes of alcoholism, I wasn't allowed to drink. And so I was a bit of a mess, but that's where I really got to feel the connection at this level of what it meant to be important to somebody. Now, even though that particular energy did not last with me, I do understand the depth of it. When you say the word dominatrix, I would like to see myself as with anything, we've got umbrellas, right? We got a lot of umbrellas,
sure.
Right? So underneath one of those umbrellas, maybe more the female led, is a femdom, mm-hmm. and female dominant. And so in my niche, it is about nurturing, disciplinarian, you know, it's all of that. And for me, it was, I understood totally what it meant to have to hide a secret. So if this is something you enjoy doing, and I have to say that I did not sit down one day and say, hey, you know what? I think I'm going to grow up and be a dom.
Right.
It's not something you wish for. So, and I saw that also with alcoholism. It's not like I sat down and said, hey, you know, I want to be an alcoholic today. So there's a reason why I have it. And so I didn't run from it. I learned about it. So in sobriety, I met other people who were sober. You know, I took classes. I did all of this stuff. I had, you know, as you read in the book, the household. And what it was like my gift to hold space for these gentlemen. Mm-hmm. And it's so much trust and so much vulnerability. And that is such an honor. To be the one to hold space for somebody like that, that level of trust. And so at that level of fulfillment, I mean, I didn't ever want to stop. I mean, because there's so many men out there who unfortunately have to wear a mask just like us women.
I totally believe it. It seems like it's part therapy, part religion in a sense, you know?
I've heard people say they work through trauma as a submissive. Absolutely. Yeah.
I wouldn't doubt it. I mean, there's something you said in there too, describing men. How did you put it? It was, you know, basically that they things were too easy for them. Life is too easy. I want resistance. And, you know, it's funny you say, because I was watching this interview once with Graham Chapman from Monty Python. You know, those guys? Mm-hmm. Graham Chapman was a recovered alcoholic, right? And I remember in this interview, he was kind of asked about his reflections on why he was an alcoholic. And when the first thing he said is, because life was too easy for me. And that always stuck out to me in a sense, because, you know, he was very, very smart guy. He mm-hmm. was, I believe he was a medical doctor in addition to being in Monty Python.
Wow.
And his explanation was essentially that life was just too easy for him. And I think that I can surmise that there's a sense of guilt that comes with that, that things are so easy for me and other people have to struggle so hard.
Yeah.
And so it's a way of like setting up obstacles for yourself, you know, mm-hmm. to almost handicap yourself in a way. Mm-hmm. I mean, psychologically, I'm sure there's a lot going on, but it was interesting when you mentioned that in your book, because the verbiage was so similar mm-hmm. and you caught a lot of flack too for being a femdom, right? Because a lot of people thought that it wasn't commiserate with what they think of as a traditional recovery story.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've had people, I had one lady who I asked, would you be my sponsor? And she declined and said, mm-hmm. no, because I don't believe in what you do. Another lady told me in my second sponsor, it said, if you don't stop what you're doing, you're going to drink. And if you drink, you will die.
There you go. Yeah.
Yeah. So some pretty heavy resistance.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd call that. I mean, it's essentially a death sentence for something but it's so weird, right? Because like on one hand, you're talking about alcoholism, something you didn't you didn't feel like you were, you made a choice to be, but you embraced it, right? Mm-hmm. And then the other side, the femdom, it's not something that you chose to be, but it chose you in a sense, and you embraced mm-hmm. it. Yes. And you definitely no regrets on the latter, right?
Oh, no. Yeah. Oh, no, it's a beautiful gift.
It seems to be. It seems to have worked wonders in your life and has made you a better person, right?
I would say the ratio of a femdom to the submissives is easily 1 to 25. Yeah. Easily. So my thoughts are something in our sexual hierarchy, something must mm-hmm. be broken if all of these men, they're missing, they have this disconnect within their most intimate relationship. They're with their partner, who whatnot. You know, there's got to be, and I've had people say, my God, please just teach my wife how to do this, you know? And it's like, I can teach you things that might bring that out in her. Yeah, and I've done that. I mean, you know, like, if you're a submissive energy, it's a yin and a yang, you know? So if you were to come in a very submissive mindset, it's going to trigger her more dominance mindset. Right. So, we don't talk about that. No, at all. Not at all.
Well, and you can't. So how much of it do you think is innate, something you were born with? How much of it do you think is because of your direct experiences? And how much, the third part, how much do you think you just learned is teachable? In being a femdom, I mean, specifically.
Because I have seen people, and that's what I joke about it, like, just be able to swing a whip. Okay, that's technique.
Sure.
That's great. And you can probably make a damn good living swinging a whip. I think... with mine, the connection it's an energy exchange. So this is something that I have to be able to have within me in order to give. So I think that right there is like a soul, something within my soul that allows me to be able to connect to individuals at this level. And I'm trying to think, you know, my mom, she was pretty dominant. I mean, she ran the households. That's what kept her safe. So perhaps some of that could have been, but I do want to clarify that when I would restrain an individual, not once did the thought cross my mind that I was getting back to what happened to me when I was younger.
Right.
There's no correlation. And I think that's what it's upsetting to think that, again, to take just the sliver of the umbrella and then, you know, paint this huge picture. It's like, there is so much more to this than me retaliating on an innocent individual. That is not, that's like the furthest thing from my mind.
Well, I mean, it's such a, culturally one of those things that, you know, few people choose to explore it unless they're naturally interested in it. Otherwise, mm-hmm. it just, everybody has a superficial understanding of things, I guess.
Yeah.
So, I mean, in a way it's understandable, I suppose. I think I was a little bit more surprised at the men who do this for a living themselves, who kind of dismissed you in the beginning. I thought maybe they would be a little bit more enlightened.
Say that again, that the men were...
The men who are also in that field, again, for lack of a better word, field, industry, et cetera, that they were somewhat dismissive of you, right? Some of these men who were professional doms. That surprised me because I thought they would have known better.
But again, anybody can grab a whip. Anybody can call themselves a top, you know? And I think it's just like with anybody. You go out with one person, it's going to feel this, but you sit down across the table from the second date and it's a completely different experience. Mm. That's exactly what this is. The part that I think was most difficult for me is who are you to impose that upon me? Like that, I think, you know, and like you were saying here about people misunderstanding, it's like, okay, then educate yourself before you pass that judgment, because the word is very, very powerful and it's very harmful if used in the wrong way. So I think that's what's most upsetting when people jump to conclusions. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think within the, and that's more in the community, like the lifestyle community that you're referring to. And let's face it, these guys have some, there are some amazing doms, male doms. Absolutely. They're nurturing. They take care of their subs. Absolutely. but usually the ones who are lipping off, they just like any other place, right? The loud one is the obnoxious one. And that's probably for a reason.
Yeah, certainly. Well, I mean, speaking of powerful words, I was wondering if you can speak to me for a moment about Source, who you refer to a lot in the book.
Yes. So when I got sober, right, I'm looking at this list on the wall of all this stuff. Now, keep in mind, I'm in Dallas, Texas. Mm-hmm. I am in the Bible Belt. So already I have kind of an oil water immersion with this whole thing. And so when I got in this room and I was like, are you kidding me? You know, I saw words like surrender and right. Oh my gosh, are you kidding me? You know, unmanageable. My life is not unmanageable. Like, do you not see what I have just done? This is ridiculous. So semantics was a really big deal for me because the power of the word, right? And so, you know, there are groups that actually use the word, you know, her in there opposed to the he. Mm-hmm. Some will just say the word God. For me, it was HP for a while, which was higher power. Mm-hmm. You know, when you get in there, you have to figure out just one thing that is bigger than you, right? And so for me, I mean, it's 100 degrees in Texas. We get out of this meeting. I must probably is like 3 months, 4 months sober. And I come out and there just happened to be this little gust of wind. And I remember when you first get sober, you are alive. Like you taste food again. You can feel the sun on your skin. I mean, you're just so raw. And the wind wrapped around me and it felt like this hug. And I thought, that's Source. Because I don't know anybody else who can move wind. Like nobody can navigate this except Source. And so as I've gone along, we can use different words, again, semantics, right?
Right.
But
right.
Really, it's the bottom. But the bottom line for me is that's love.
Yeah.
Love.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's beautiful. I don't even think you really have to think too much about where it comes from. It just seemed to have been naturally occurring to you.
And I think I want to think that people are born with that. I really do.
Well, did you have a lot of religion when you were a kid?
My mom was Catholic until she divorced my first father. And then she wasn't allowed to go back to that church anymore. So, right. It was really not, I mean, I went to catechism. I did the Eucharist and all, but it was like, it didn't make sense to me. It didn't connect to me at all. It was just something I had to do.
Well, yeah, I mean, I grew up with a lot of it. And I think that when you do, you just kind of, your relationship with that, with the source is mm-hmm. just different because I don't want to say tainted, but it is certainly I codified differently.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I wish that we did things like meditation or anything to turn inward. Yeah, to find what our source looks like. Like if I would have learned that, oh my gosh, if I would have learned that at age 5, this whole storyline would be totally different, right?
Absolutely. I think that that's a dangerous thought in a sense, but it's such a, but it's a wonderful thought. I think, the Buddhists had that right. I think even early Christianity, if I have this correctly, the early texts and translations, it's essentially what Jesus was saying was to look inward, mm-hmm. right? What's in, you have to bring out. So in other words, like, I think that's always been known to be the source of any sort of peace or equanimity is to keep looking inwards. You can't expect things from outside of you to fix you. It doesn't work.
Yes.
But it does if you want power and control over people. And I think that's when, yes. Yeah.
And that's what we learned in recovery is that people, places, and things had to change. Mm. And you have to go inward. You know, that's a huge journey.
Yeah.
Huge journey.
It's a scary place.
It's right? Very scary. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Because it's not pretty. And it 99% of the time is going to be messy. You're going to look like a fool. You're going to cry. You're going to. Yeah.
Yeah. That's hard. There's no crutches. There's no one to really help you. There's no real guides. Mm-mm. I think.
No.
Yeah. But I do want to. I wanted to ask you a little bit about TV too, because you had this great line too about energy and putting boundaries on your energy. Mm-hmm. Something like even a toxicity coming through the TV screen can shift my whole evening. I know exactly how you feel. And I was wondering if you can talk to me a little bit about how you shift that energy.
You know, I learned this when I studied Deepak Chopra. He really emphasized about how the internet, this is back when, you know, we started to realize like how powerful a simple post can be. Like I can shoot up a picture that is just this beautiful, warm and fuzzy pic. And someone in the Netherlands will be like, oh, that's a beautiful pic. And then that kind of, you know, radiates out into that world. But then the same thing, like on the opposite side of that, I can show something that's, you know, horrific or abusive. And then that shoots over. And so the same thing. So I became very, very mindful of the energy that was around me. What was I putting into my brain, into my body? I mean, we're energy fields, energy fields. So I became very, very mindful of that. And it's amazing when you do, because there's times I met a person one time and it was like this whole, like from happy down to tears in my eyes, I was like, what just happened? I mean, it was after one of the recovery meetings and my friend was like, well, that was an emotional vampire. And I was just like, and that's what they, you know, to suck the energy, the people who do, there's people who are very, very manipulative. And so to realize that that even exists was huge for me because I read rooms when I was younger, right? I got to feel it out in here. Is it safe? Is it not safe? You know?
Right.
So that's one of the tools that I learned that are now one of my benefits.
Yeah. I mean, I'm glad you brought that up too, because there's a couple things in your story that I think were the background to a lot of, you know, what makes you, you, but things that I couldn't help but really connect with both personally and just narratively through the story. One of them was TV, right? That like when I was reading about some of your stories as a child, it's like, that's, I was raised by a TV. Like I, you know, your story about Webster. And stuff like that. I remember when like Webster was used as this like morality example, you know?
And that was like, so TV uncomfortable.
Oh God. Yes. Like I can only imagine. I can't imagine what that felt like. But the other thing though, too, was the internet and how much the internet was a big part of your story. Because every time things started to become a little bit unraveled, you went online and you met somebody either for the better, for the positive or for the negative, but that's where you went. And there's this thing that I just couldn't help but wonder, like, what if she had been born a few years before this, you know, I wonder what would have happened. Do you ever think about that? Like without the internet or without being able to rely on it? Cause it seems like it's done both positive and negative things for you, right?
Yeah, it absolutely has. And now I'm grateful that I do realize the power of it and what I do put out there. But yeah, I guess I've never thought about like, what would it have been like if I didn't have that vehicle? I probably would have just spun out in a very small geographical area. I mean, the internet.
What else could you do? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's beautiful things about that. I got to, you know, I was in many areas of the United States, you know, I learned how to be a chameleon, you know, by becoming who these people needed me to be. You know, I just recently wrote a blog about how all of the thorns of my, you know, a childhood have now become the gems of my adulthood. Mm. And it's profound to look at your story in that light.
It is. Isn't that crazy and kind of paradoxical in a sense, right? That like you had to go through so much horror to be so at peace and to feel so good about yourself now. And yet your mission is to help young people avoid those thorns that may one day make them better people. I think about this a lot as an educator, that like part of me thinks I should be kicking them in the face and throwing them downstairs so that they get something.
Yes.
You know what I mean? It's just so
weird.
I do.
And you know, people will say that like, oh my God, you had such a horrific upbringing. To be very honest, the way I see it is that, and this may be upsetting for some people, but the way I see it and got peace with it is that these are things that I endured. I didn't choose to do this, right? So I endured these things. Source was next to me because clearly I made it through these things. And then it's like, what do you do with that gift? Right. And so in order for me to have the miraculous life I have today of emotional freedom and vulnerability and authenticity, because I had to have that contrast. you know, and I'm not, and I know childhood trauma is a touchy subject, but just like when we go to the gym, the muscle has to tear before it builds. Right. Yeah. You're not going to look like this over here without the pain.
Right.
Yeah.
So the pain is absolutely necessary. I mean, life is suffering, isn't it?
Yeah,
it is.
It is.
Yeah.
But not to the point though. When I hear the word suffering, I think of like down and out suffering. Maybe it's because I was so close to it, but
I think of it more in the Dostoevskian sense, you know, in that like it is something that we must endure and that we can be better as a result of it.
Yes.
It's unavoidable.
And yeah. Yeah. And that's, I had to unlearn that a little bit. Like, okay, it doesn't mean that I have to be on Skid Row and, you know, not that degree of suffering. Right. Again, semantics is a really big deal for me.
Yeah. Well, me too. I think it's one of the, as a teacher, you know, if there's one thing that I could bring back to students, it's semantics.
Yeah.
As a class, as a discipline, I think it is so important to learn the meanings of words and what can be done with them.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, I think about it constantly in politics. I think about it constantly on Twitter. I mean, it's without understanding the meaning of words and their power. I mean, we're all kind of, you know, potential victims of their tyranny.
Yeah.
So I love how you decide to become a bodybuilder. I did not even expect that as part of the story. That was such a fantastic turn of events.
So how that all came up was one of the things that my mom taught me was a body image issue. Mm-hmm. And as her daughter, of course, I adored my mother. You know, I would see that fight that would take place. And it was, I was 1 year sober and my mom had just gone through, she was in ICU and she had cancer. She had lung cancer and they removed the entire lung. And so she was in ICU. She was very medicated. And I just, you know, she's coming to, and the first words that rolled out of her mouth was that she was going to fit into those skinny jeans. Mm-hmm. And right there, this aha moment of programming. Yeah. And it was like, this is stupid. And so I, of course, had the same belief system she did. And so I had a terrible relationship with my body, but I got tired of fighting it. I got tired of being tired. Mm-hmm. And so that's when I took that plunge, right? Like, okay, I'm going to step foot into this huge bodybuilding gym. I mean, the pictures, oh my gosh, Billy, I have a tint of green in these pictures because I'm standing there in pretty much my underwear as she's taken the before pictures.
Yeah.
But I desperately wanted to change that. And so it's just the relationship with myself, just like all the other things that have changed in my life. I particularly love the physique of the human body is just miraculous to me. And so if I can, you know, chisel away and sculpt this and that, the whole bodybuilding thing that's kind of on the side. It's something I do, you know, for fun. I don't know if I would do it as a full-time career, but that was just a byproduct of it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's all, I guess, not to get too psychoanalytical about it, but it is all about control. Isn't it? Is it about having control of your body and control of your story? I mean, being a writer, being a bodybuilder, it's all about controlling who you are, right?
You know, I have laid my stuff out, the good, the ugly.
Yeah.
I know what it feels like to hold control and need to have control. I don't feel that today. Mm-hmm. I don't feel like I need to, you know, dominate the room and same with the way my body is. I like the way I feel when I eat right. You know, I like the way I feel at age 49 and get in a two-piece bikini. I love the way that feels. So if that means I'm going to challenge this body of mine, if I'm going to take it to these degrees, you know, it's pretty much the same thing I did when I got sober. You know, it's that desperation. And that's what I've done.
That's great. Can you tell me a little bit about your routine then? What are you doing now?
I am about 3 weeks out from a show right now. So it's pretty intense. Typically, I'll just work, train like 5 days a week. But right now, I'm up to 6 days a week. I have a very in-depth meal plan. Every mm-hmm. Sunday, I do a weigh-in and send my pictures to my coach. He then puts together the meal plan for the following week. And now I'll be getting, as I get closer to the show date, we'll start pulling some carbs out and, you know, just kind of like to dehydrate a little bit. And then I'll do the whole water thing, which is sometimes very uncomfortable, but I'll increase a lot of water. And then over the course of that last week, then I'll start, you know, taking the water off and then voila, this whole new side comes out.
I mean, I'm such a like a novice when it comes to even this subject. I mean, I watched the movie Pumping Iron a couple of times. I thought that was pretty great. I've read stories about these trainers like scarfing handfuls of dry oatmeal, right? Is that's a thing? Do people do that?
It's not a thing for me, but yes, there are. Yes, if they drink water when they didn't supposed to.
I mean, I just think human beings are amazing when they put themselves through these challenges to, I don't know. I mean, it could be looked upon as vanity, I suppose, and part of it is. But as you mentioned, like there's a beauty to it as well. And the beauty is not just so much in the looking good in the bikini. I think it's the feeling good. As you say, you feel better when you eat this way. The sculpting of muscles. That's what I got out of Pumping Iron. It's an art. I mean, they're very serious. Very serious about this.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And I think that's one of those umbrellas where people are like, in fact, one of my sponsors had said, when are you going to stop hating your body? Because I was doing these things too. Like, why aren't you just going to accept it the way it is? It's like, wow. But everybody has different belief systems. So
yes, yeah, so you had to kind of reverse that thinking, right? And saying like, this is not a symptom of hating your body. This is a symptom of you loving your body.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
More than anything, this is authentic to me today.
Mm-hmm.
That is the number one thing. I have to always have clear intentions. You know, what are my motives? That's really where I look at it. People put tattoos on their body. We color our hair. Mm-hmm. We put all these crazy clothes on or off. It's really falls right within that list. Like, how do you want to exist in this body?
Yes. Yeah. I think that's so, hopeful too, that the older you get, the more comfortable you've felt, it seems like, as your book progressed as well.
Yes. Yeah. I've been told like I'm fine wine because it's like, as I get older, it's like, wait, this is supposed to be the other way around, but I see it as I have a second shot. I have part two of my life.
Well, do you, are there any resentments at all towards the young? Let me just ask. You look at young people and say, I wish I was still 21 again. I wish I was 30.
To be honest, my husband has a son. And I remember going into that, that co-parenting. And I remember being very angry about a lot of things. Like, what do you mean he doesn't have a bicycle? Like, what kid doesn't have a bicycle, and really having a lot of conflict within. But what I try to do, and that now is he's older, so I can actually talk with him. Now what I try to do, like, cause I'll look as I think a lot of people, you look at this next generation coming in and we're like, ah, you know what? That's what my parents did. And that's probably what their parents are going to do. I mean, but so I hope that I get to, instead of like, resist it, like technology. I can't resist technology. Why do I have to resist it? These kids know what they're doing.
Right.
Teach me, show me. So yeah, always being teachable.
Ah, yes, yes. Yes. I think that's a great way to put it.
Yeah.
Technology is just one of those things where I feel a semantic word. I mean, what does it mean? I mean, language is a technology. I mean, technology is so important, and yet it is something to be, every time we embrace it, we lose something. That's the thing I think we don't talk about. We just do not talk about that very much.
So explain that. Every time we embrace it, we lose something.
Well, so for example, you know, there's an ancient Greek parable about when the gift of writing was given to us from the gods. There was a Greek king, I'm probably butchering part of this, but the king essentially asked, but what do we lose with this invention of writing? What do we lose with this gift? I feel like we will lose our memories. And in a way, he was right, right? Because at that time, you know, the great poems of Homer, et cetera, were all memorized, right? They were memorized by these bards that would travel around and memorize, you know, hundreds upon pages worth of material. And once human beings began to write things down, we don't have to remember as much, right? And so that's just one example from thousands upon thousands of years ago. So now every time we're introduced to a new technology, there are always gifts that come with it, but there are always consequences too.
Mm-hmm.
We don't talk about what we lose anymore. There's no great king to say, well, with a smartphone, what we may lose a few things that we should consider before we all carry one. There's no one who's really doing that. We just kind of embrace it all excitedly.
And I think as generations, like we go way over to one side and then we find the happy medium, right?
Hopefully, yeah.
And I think that's what's happening. Now we are mindful that, oh, if you put a kid behind the computer screen for this many hours, he's now going to lack in social skills. Okay, so now we know this, right? So the pendulum is kind of coming back, right? We're using it now for things like physical fitness. And so that gives me hope that that balance will be found.
I hope so. Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, there's always an optimist way of looking at it, but then something with COVID comes along, right? Mm-hmm. And that is one of the unintended consequences of that is now we're back to the screens. I agree with you. We were getting to that point where we're like, we shouldn't be on screens so much. It's not good for our kids. Kids shouldn't be on screens. But now if you want to learn, you got to be on your screen. You got to be on your screen 8 hours a day on your screen, get on your screen with your teacher. And so what is that doing to young people? What is it doing to us? Because you and I are talking through a screen. So again, I appreciate the benefits of it because through this podcast, I've had wonderful conversations with people from across the world that I wouldn't normally have.
Yes.
But we're losing something. I have a feeling that you and I would have a better conversation if we were in person because experience has taught me that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's better than not having met you at all. I mean, there are just these ups and downs to this.
Yes. And I think we've not evolved enough to be able to capture the energy between the two of us as we, you know, have our conversation.
Do you think we will? That's a question for you. Do you think we'll evolve to a point where we can capture that energy digitally?
Well, energy is detectable, so I don't see why not.
Ah, that's an interesting thought.
We look at energy on the microwave, you know, the scale of different UV, you know, microwave, all of the different energy levels. So
I suppose. I think we are desiring to get to that point. I see society moving in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, with holograms, things like, I mean, we are getting to that point where we are wanting to be comfortable with digital images in a room as we are with physical human beings. And again, I'm a little fearful of that.
I'm a little weary too.
Yeah.
But the cool thing is that we've been taught other ways. And we do get to be fulfilled with things like walking in the park, enjoying the sunshine. You know what I'm saying? So I would just have to think that as the world evolves, like we received what we needed during that time. And so I see technology as that's a source thing. I mean, that's an amazing gift that we get. So I'd have to think that if source took care of us, drinking out of hoses and you know, things that we did, I would have to think that this is also in the same wave. Do you know what I mean?
I do. I really hope so. I do know what you mean. And I want to believe it. I want to be as optimistic as you are. I do.
I guess the thing is too, is that I've seen things change 110%. I was behind a trash can with a broken bottle in my hand, ready to end my life. I've seen things that people don't think are possible. I'm living proof of that.
That's a great way to put it. Because if society is essentially just, you know, a collection of individuals and you as an individual has experienced that, mm-hmm. if we as a society are experiencing a suicidal moment, a bottoming out moment, are we capable of coming to our best selves as a group? Mm-hmm. It seems like yes. I mean, what why can't we?
We hope so.
Yeah.
We hope so. It's tough when it comes to the masses. That's hard for me. Mm-hmm. I can't, because it's so far out of my realm.
Right.
But when you and I talk, just between the two of us, that's right sized for me. So yeah. Then I think then I would be able to give an opinion on that. But unless I experience something or have that sort of experience, if I don't, I don't have an opinion. Mm. That's where I try to stay.
That's probably advisable. So your book was a message to that girl at the back of the room.
Mm.
I have to ask, what can we as adults do to make sure that girl is recognized? What could I as a male adult do to recognize those girls at the back of the room who are suffering in silence?
You know, I would wonder at times, like, how could my mom not see this? Mm-hmm. How could the women in my life not see this? And I look at me as I was very withdrawn. I was very uncertain, very quiet and reserved. But I also know on the other side of that is that rage and that anger, and that is all in the same vein. So a lot of times when we discount people for being, you know, a mess or whatnot, it's like, hold up. What's causing this? You know, one of the many cool things about the rooms of recovery is that when we come in there, like I know when I did, I was a hot mess. I was angry. I mean, I was disrespectful. I was all those things because I just endured a whole bunch of junk, whole bunch of stuff. I just survived that, right? So I was fighting any and everything around me. You know, so when something seems really out of place, like what's the source of that? Why, what is that? And there are times where many times I'm sure I talked to different people along my path. Sometimes you're just a seed planter. Yeah. Sometimes I think it's, you know, like a 15-year window actually before most women come to the surface about any sort of abuse. So because the body is protecting it so much, you know, through the blackouts or whatnot, denial of some sort, I'm sure.
Sure.
So, but just to be able to like pause for a moment and not let the reactions, your instinctual reactions come up and be like, wow, that's a lot of anger coming out of that little girl. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it may just be saying, hey, good to see you.
Yeah.
We just plant.
Are you okay? Can I get you anything?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, my name's Billy. Good to meet you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And I think that's it too. Like my example is always in the rooms of recovery. It's like, I will probably not get to see the happy ever after. That's not my part. That's God's, like the outcome is God's, right? What I have to do is I get to plant the seed. It's the smile. It's looking somebody in the eyes. It's just pausing for a minute, even if they're down on their phone or whatever. Hey, good morning. Do you know what I'm saying? Yeah. They're so
powerful. I do.
So powerful. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a tough culture out there right now. Really tough. So it's the simple things.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much for joining me.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you.